Filled with the scent of potpourri. Films we commit to memory. Crossing the felt ropes, watching from home on my TV. Looking at all my eyes can see. They tell me I view obsessively.
Hello and welcome to The Obsessive Viewer. We're a weekly podcast that reviews one or two new release titles every episode with an occasional free-for-all segment at the end that we call Potpourri. You can find more of our work, including written reviews, full episode show notes, and the complete backlog of our episodes at obsessiveviewer.com. You can also write into the show by emailing me at matt@obsessiveviewer.com. And if you'd like to support us and get access to hundreds of exclusive episodes, you can join our Patreon at patreon.com/obsessiveviewer, where you can get access to content at any of our tier levels, as I put a pillow behind my back for comfort. Any of our tier levels on a recurring monthly subscription basis, or you can buy individual collections a la carte in the Patreon shop section. This week on Patreon, I've just released some early access to anthology episodes. I'm getting back to doing more Patreon stuff. I've just been very busy, so I apologize for that. But anyway, you can get access to tons of stuff on Patreon, aside from the stuff I haven't released in the last week, at patreon.com/obsessiveviewer. I'm your host, Matt Hurt, and you can find me on social media, including Letterboxd at obsessiveviewer. And in my feature review this week, I'll be reviewing Dev Patel's directorial debut, Monkey Man, which opened in theaters on April 5th. And for my secondary review this week, I'm going to review the documentary Girl State, which was released on Apple TV Plus on April 5th as well. And as I have been doing intermittently here and there, I've been doing live streams and video content on the YouTube channel for Obsessive Viewer podcasts. Right now, I believe I only have one person in the chat. So hi, Paige. Thank you for joining. So it's a little bit nerve-wracking to do that like live stream thing. So anyway, it's there. And then I'm going to have video content on the YouTube channel later. So this is an interesting episode because I'm doing a solo episode of Obsessive Viewer, and this is actually the day before the episode is going to post. So usually I give myself a couple of days, cut some leeway, but I kind of push the recording to the day before. So yeah, that's a little behind the scenes. I've had a very busy week in terms of podcast related stuff, and it's been kind of great. It's been kind of amazing. So like Monday, I recorded the secondary review for next week's episode of Obsessive Viewer. So Mike and I reviewed Late Night with the Devil. And then yesterday I recorded an episode of Anthology for Anthology with my friend Victor. That's going to go up on Friday. It's on Patreon now. And then right now, Wednesday, I'm recording this episode. And then tomorrow night, I'm recording next week's Anthology episode with Tiny. So it's a very stacked week. It's very, very stacked. Busy. So I haven't hit the wall yet, but rest assured it's coming. So as is customary, this episode is going to basically take the structure of me doing news items and news and little bits of information from the entertainment world before getting into the featured review. The featured review, as I said, is going to be for Monkey Man, Dev Patel's directorial debut, and that's going to take the form of a non-spoiler review followed by a spoiler review, and then I'm going to wrap up with a non-spoiler secondary review of Girl State. So, having said all of that, let me go ahead and let my voice crack on the mic once again and go into news before the reviews. So I've got a few news items here that I kind of want to run down a little bit and share my thoughts on. They're a varying interest level for me. So the first one I have is that Kevin Smith, his next movie is a movie called The 4:30 Movie. It is was just picked up by Saban Films. And here's the thing. So here's the thing. My understanding is that Kevin Smith bought the movie theater that he grew up going to all the time. And he has basically made a film set in the, I think, 70s or I think it's the 80s. It sounds like a slacker hangout movie, but he has set it in that time frame at that theater. And let me just read from Deadline. So it says, set in the summer of 1986, the coming of age comedy follows three 16-year-old friends who spend their Saturday sneaking into movies at the local multiplex. But when one of the guys also invites the girl of his dreams to see the latest comedy, each of the teens will learn something serious about life and love before the credits roll. And here's the thing. I do not believe... I'm willing to be proven wrong on this, but I do not believe Kevin Smith has it in him to do another good movie. Like, I have fallen off of Kevin Smith as a filmmaker steadily since really Jay and Silent Bob reboot. Really, Tusk was the start of that. But Tusk, and then from there, I never saw Yoga Hosers, but Jay and Silent Bob reboot was very not good. And so that was very much not good. And then Clerks 3 happened, and Clerks 3 was a travesty for me. I just hated that movie with such a burning passion, and it's enough to make me just write off Kevin Smith. Like, I don't think that I am really in the camp of Kevin Smith being making anything more that would be interesting to me. And I know that that's probably a little bit of a crappy position to be in regarding a filmmaker, that I actually really like a lot of his movies, but that's just how bad Clerks 3 was for me. And this movie, the 4:30 movie, is a little bit in defiance of that in my head, because on paper, this is the type of movie that I adore. I love coming of age movies, especially a movie centered around like movies and movie going and movie theaters, the nostalgia of that. All of that sounds right up my alley. I just don't have faith in Kevin Smith anymore. Like, I really don't. It's that's how bad his trajectory, his filmmaking has gotten for me. And I don't know. I mean, I will reserve judgment, of course, but I'll also, it'll be an uphill battle. But the movie also has, in the cast, it has Ken Jeong, Sam Richardson, who I love, Genesis Rodriguez, Justin Long, Jason Lee, Rachel Drash, Kate Micucci, Adam Pally, Harley Quinn Smith, and Method Man. So I don't know. We'll see what happens with that. I don't know. I don't know exactly when it's supposed to come out. I just know that it was bought by Saban Films. And I don't know. It doesn't say like when it, if it has any leads on when it will be kind of brought out, but that's the 4:30 movie, and we'll see what happens. I'm sure I'll talk about it in some capacity, either on the podcast or on Patreon at some point when it comes out. So that's one news item that I have, and the second one is a much more exciting one. It's Tim Robinson and Zach Kanin, who they are the creative force behind I Think You Should Leave, which is one of my favorite like comedy anythings. It's a sketch comedy show on Netflix. It is 100% my type of humor, 100% just what I love about comedy. And Tim Robinson is the center of it, and he's phenomenal. So the news broke on April 2nd that Tim Robinson and Zach Kanin, they have a comedy called The Chair Company that got an HBO pilot order. With Adam McKay producing. Adam McKay, I'm a little, I don't know about that. But the summary of it, the details of it are that, is that The Chair Company, written and executive produced by Tim Robinson and Zach Kanin. It follows, after an embarrassing incident at work, a man finds himself investigating a far-reaching conspiracy. So it's a comedy, and from the sound of it, it sounds like it's going to take... It sounds like it'll take a bit of a bit of a nod from I Think You Should Leave. Like, this, the plot summary of it sounds very much like an I Think You Should Leave sketch. Like, there are sketches in I Think You Should Leave that sound exactly like this type of sketch, like this type of storyline. I'm thinking in particular, like, the whoopee cushion one, which is an all-timer favorite sketch of mine, where he sits down on a chair in a meeting at work and someone has a whoopee cushion on it and he takes it literally, or he tries to just understand what the joke is. And it's just, it's that brand of comedy. Like, I hope that this has that same type of energy, in that it's the kind of through line of I Think You Should Leave, for the most part, is someone experiencing something and not letting it go, or experiencing something and carrying it to the, like, extreme of cringe comedy. And I hope that The Chair Company follows suit in this. I don't know. Like, here's the thing. So Tim Robinson is going to play the main character, the man who finds himself investigating a far-reaching conspiracy. And it's, he can do either way. Like, he can do either way. He could do, like, the heightened, like, crazy character who is taking things too seriously or taking things too silly, like, at any end of the spectrum, or he can play the straight man in this, with everyone else being crazy and comedy leaning. So I don't know. It could go either way, and I'm very happy with either way. So, and it also says that the pickup. To a half hour starring. Anyway, that's all that it says about that. So, don't know when that'll come out, but I'll put a link in the show notes, of course. Very excited for this, because I really like Tim Robinson's brand of comedy. And in fact, I Think You Should Leave went on tour, and I'm so mad that it didn't come to Indianapolis. Like, I would 100% have gone to, like, I Think You Should Leave, the, like, stage, whatever, the live performance of it. I saw some TikToks of it from Detroit, and, like, it just looks fun. It looks like fun. And like I said, I Think You Should Leave is one of my favorite comedy anythings, and I think it would have been just really great to see it. But unfortunately, they didn't come to Indianapolis. Unrelated to any of that, someone that is coming to Indianapolis in August is Comedy Bang Bang, and I really want to try to go to that. I don't know how much tickets are. I think the pre-sale is, like, this week or something, but I don't know how much it is, but I want to actively look into that, because I would love to see Comedy Bang Bang live. The next piece of news that I have is from Bloody Disgusting. The headline is "New Matrix Movie in the Works from the Cabin in the Woods Director Drew Goddard." I haven't read much about this, but I don't know. The Matrix Resurrections came out in 2021, late 2021. And it was fine. It was interesting, but I don't know. Like, it didn't really grab me. It didn't really satisfy me in terms of, like, any type of, like, concluding chapter of that franchise, or it didn't excite me for future installments. It was just mediocre. It was just kind of middle of the road. I did appreciate that. I think, was it Lana Wachowski? Or it might have been, I can't remember which one directed it. I think it was Lana, but anyway, I did like the kind of trans allegory for in Matrix Resurrections, how it is kind of an interesting inverse of the kind of the one arc for Neo, and how it's kind of it's shifted over to Trinity for Matrix Resurrections. I liked that about it, but this, I don't know. Like, I like Drew Goddard as a filmmaker. I love The Cabin in the Woods, and he's written some things that I really liked. I think he wrote the first Cloverfield movie. He wrote Cloverfield. And I think that he is a good person to be given the keys to the Matrix, I would say, specifically because he is comfortable wading into those genre bending sort of spaces. So, like, Cloverfield was, like, a monster kaiju movie, but found footage and had some interesting stories, storytelling in that regard. And then, of course, Cabin in the Woods is, I mean, that's as much genre bending as you can get. Like, that is a horror satire, but played straight. And it encompasses so many different elements of horror in a horror comedy kind of space too. So I don't know. Oh, he also worked on Daredevil, which I think it was yesterday. It was the like 9-year anniversary of the premiere of Daredevil on Netflix. But anyway, yeah, I don't know what this fifth Matrix movie is going to be like, or what the plan is. I don't know if it's going to be like a single installment with the intention of maybe doing further installments after that, if it's successful. But I don't know. I don't know. The statement in the article says, and this is from, I think this is from, okay, so Lana Wachowski will be on board as executive producers. That makes me feel a little bit better about it. But the quote from Warner Brothers Pictures president of production, Jesse Ehrman, said, "Drew came to Warner Brothers with a new idea that we all believe would be an incredible way to continue the Matrix world by both honoring what Lana and Lily began over 25 years ago and offering a unique perspective based on his own love of the series and characters. The entire team at Warner Brothers Discovery is thrilled for Drew to be making this new Matrix film, adding his vision to the cinematic canon the Wachowskis spent a quarter of a century building here at the studio." That's interesting. That's really interesting that they're at least presenting it as Drew Goddard coming to Warner Brothers with an idea. Like this, I don't know how like honest that is. Like, I don't know how truthful that is, because so much of the Matrix Resurrections was built around kind of creating this identity or this idea of Warner Brothers trying to cash in on the Matrix franchise. So I don't know if this is like, this is a statement that's crafted by design to kind of take us away from that idea. But I don't know, that does kind of make me feel a little bit better about it, that it is something that Drew Goddard had like in his mind. And his statement regarding it is, quote, "It is not hyperbole to say the Matrix films changed both cinema and my life. Lana and Lily's exquisite artistry inspires me on a daily basis, and I am beyond grateful for the chance to tell stories in their world." So we'll see what happens. That's the new Matrix movie is in the works. We'll see what happens. And the final piece of news that I have is yesterday, I think it was yesterday, yeah. The first trailer for Joker Folie à Deux was released, and I don't have it queued up or anything to play on the live stream or in the recording or anything, so I apologize for that. But I'll just talk briefly about it. I liked Joker. I liked Joker when it came out in, like, what, 2019, I think. I enjoyed it more than I expected to. The attitude and the conversations surrounding it were really not to my liking. Like, I think it's one of those things that, certain like chodes, of people online, kind of took it by the reins and just kind of became insufferable about it. But aside from that, outside of the response to it, the reaction to it, and the kind of trolly nature of it, I did think that Joker was solid. I do not think it was Academy Award worthy solid, like by any stretch, but I do think that it was an interesting bend on Batman lore, I guess. Like, that, I don't know. It's hard to say because Joker is such a weird character. He's such a character that demands ambiguity, and Joker just kind of flies in the face of that in a big way. But I don't know. I'm a little bit back and forth on Joker, the first movie. But the trailer for this one, I will say that my interest in Joker Folie à Deux is very small. I am not that interested in it. It's going to be a jukebox musical with Lady Gaga playing Harley Quinn, which that's somewhat interesting, I guess. But I don't know. The trailer just kind of seems a little bit... It didn't do much for me. And there's a lot of people like online saying like, oh my God, the end scene of the trailer where she paints a smiley face on it and then the camera positions it so that he's smiling on the other side of the glass. It's like, that's not... Like my thing is that it just kind of lingered on that a little too much. And it was like Todd Phillips trying to be clever, but it's not a very clever shot by any stretch, but I don't know. So I did have this idea about Joker Folie à Deux that if it went this route, I think I would be a little bit more interested in it. But basically, like, before I say what my theory is or what my hope for Joker 2 is, let me just say that this is a very rudimentary idea of what the movie could be. And I'll get back to that later when I say it. So basically, my thought is it would be sort of interesting if Joker Folie à Deux took the structure of the first like two-thirds of the movie. Like, let's say it's a two-hour movie. The first half of the movie would be interesting if it is this jukebox musical where Joker and Harley meet in Arkham Asylum, and then they break out and they go on this crazy, vibrant, like silly crime spree through Gotham that's all presented through this jukebox musical. And then at the halfway point or at the end of the like second act, it would be interesting if the movie drops that completely and either just shows that like, oh, that whole thing was in Joker's mind, like in Arthur's mind, a figment of his imagination, or that his imagining of it was the jukebox musical. So, and then the last like third or half of the movie would take a more gritty, like realistic view of it. So my imagining of Joker Folie à Deux is that a large portion of it would be this weird, whimsical, goofy jukebox musical, heightened reality, crime spree thing of two just completely insane, crazy, unstable people falling in love through this jukebox musical. And then it drops that and becomes this incredibly like violent and sadistic, like realistic depiction of the violence that they're doing. I think, like, I keep thinking about that. And on one hand, I'm like, that would be really interesting. That would be a really interesting way to do it. A really interesting way to do a Joker sequel and to position it like that. That would be really interesting. And my other thing is, I feel like Todd Phillips is just dumb enough to do that. Like I feel like it's not that clever because my dumbass thought of it. So like, I think it would be neat, but I also think that that's like bare minimum in terms of what the structure of a Joker sequel would be. But yeah, so that's my kind of thought on it. I think it's still set to come out in October. We'll see, but the trailer's out there, and yeah, that's Joker Folie à Deux. Yeah, and that is all the news that I have for this section of the episode. Now let me go ahead and go right in to my featured review for the evening, which is for Dev Patel's directorial debut, Monkey Man. So as is the case, I'm going to do a non-spoiler review followed by a spoiler review. Once I go into spoilers, I'm going to play a clip from the trailer, and once that plays, we'll go into spoilers. So let me go ahead and go into my non-spoiler review for Monkey Man, and to bring me into that, I'm going to read the plot summary courtesy of IMDb. Monkey Man, by the way, is in theaters now. It was released in theaters April 4th. 4th or 5th, I don't remember what I said, April 5th, last week. My voice keeps cracking. But anyway, so the premise, according to IMDb, is an anonymous young man unleashes a campaign of vengeance against the corrupt leaders who murdered his mother and continue to systemically victimize the poor and powerless. The movie is directed by Dev Patel, as I've said. Writers were Paul Gunawala and John Colley, with a story by credit by Dev Patel. The cast includes Dev Patel, Charlton Copley, Pitobash, Vipin Sharma, and Sikander Kerr. And I saw this in theaters. I saw it in Dolby Theater. Yeah, in Dolby. And I was pretty excited about it just because I really like and respect Dev Patel as a performer. In particular, I loved his performance in The Green Knight. He was also in that movie in 2016, Lion, which I thought was incredibly moving and a great exercise of like a star vehicle for him in particular. Like, his performance in that movie is so moving and incredible in terms of the drama. He plays a man who is, he's like displaced from his home as a child, and he's adopted by Australian parents. And then it's about him in his adulthood trying to find his birth parents. And it's incredibly moving. It's beautiful. Really fantastic. So those are kind of the two big performances in his career as of late that I find really, really like stand out. The Green Knight and Lion are two very good performances from him. So the idea of him doing an action movie as his directorial debut definitely had me intrigued. I didn't know much of anything about the actual plot before I went into it. And so in fact, like, the plot summary that I read from IMDb gives a lot of detail in terms of his motivations, because, like, it says an anonymous young man unleashes a campaign of vengeance against the corrupt leaders who murdered his mother. Like, that element of the plot is something that isn't really explicitly shown or stated in the movie until probably about the halfway point. It's very clear that's his motivation, and that's what he's doing, all the things that he does in service of and in vengeance of, but we don't get the details of that until late in the movie. And I found that pretty interesting and bordering on frustrating, because the movie does something that is kind of ballsy, in that it takes this backstory and conceals it from us. It takes the backstory, keeps it from us, and then goes about taking us on a ride through his experience of doing this vengeance plot without giving us the context of why he's doing it or what has happened that spurred him toward doing this big vengeance thing. Going on this big violent thing. So why I say that that's a ballsy choice from him is that it's definitely something that is that is giving us the expectation, or is done with the expectation, that we will be on board with what's going on, and that we will, like, it will hold our attention. And for the most part, it definitely does hold our attention. Like, there are sequences early in this movie where we know that he's plotting things, we know that he's orchestrating things to try to get into a certain position so that he can exact his revenge. That buildup is basically like the first act, or maybe the first like 45 minutes of the movie. And it's really solid. It's really interesting. And the way that he tells the story is really engaging, because with that absence of backstory, he needs to make it interesting visually and interesting through dialogue to bring us to the point where we care about him exacting his vengeance and doing his whole vengeance thing. And he does a really good job of that through two avenues. One is he keeps it mysterious while giving us a little bit of hints here and there. We get flashes of of the big thing that happened that spurred everything. The like we get flashes and details, like we see like, yeah, his hands are very badly burned. We see just flashes of images of blood and fire and a bunch of stuff without the context of it. And in addition to that, we also are guided through the story by like these very intense and kinetic fight sequences where the character is credited as being named Kid. He's just referred to as Kid, so I'm just going to call Dev Patel's character Kid. But we get like very brutal sequences where Kid is fighting in a like an underground boxing match or UFC style like fight club thing, and we eventually learn like he's doing that to earn money and to kind of make it to get to a point where he can exact his revenge and everything. So these sequences of just brutal fight sequences and violence are kind of, on one hand, they're one of the standouts of the movie. I enjoyed this aspect of it, at least at the front of the movie. There's like one whole sequence where there's a big sequence like that, a big fight club sequence like that toward the end of the movie that I just kind of felt like, okay, I understand why you're doing this in the story, but the storyline has advanced far enough to where I don't need this. Like now I don't need, like we've had a bunch of other action set pieces and then now we're back to the underground fight club thing. And it just felt very bloated. Like it bloated out the runtime a little bit, or bloated out the movie a little bit and detracted from the main storyline. But I'll get to that later, probably in the spoiler section. So, the beginning of the movie with this underground fight club thing is really interestingly done, because it, first of all, you have from the trailer, like the monkey mask that he wears. It's very, aesthetically speaking, it's pretty cool and interesting. And he just gets this shit pummeled out of him. Like he gets completely just decimated. He gets his ass kicked through it. And that's really interesting, because it really showcases all like the like it is a very violent depiction of him getting his ass kicked. It's not even like an underdog story where he's like getting his ass kicked and then like, oh, I'm gonna get the upper hand, or this is my motivation to try to do something to help people or to get the upper hand in my own scheming and everything. It's just him getting his ass kicked. And it's bloody, it's vicious, and the way that it's filmed and the way that other sequences in the movie are filmed, and action set pieces are filmed, it has this energy to it, this kinetic, like the camera movement is so kind of frenetic and crazy. Like it's not disorienting, it's done with such a measured hand that's surprising, especially from a first-time filmmaker to kind of storyboard this and to do the shots this way. But it's very chaotic and very crazy. It's really well done, and it really brought me into it. And then that's a good way to have like a sample of the action up front with this underground fight club aspect of the story. When the movie advances, like there's a whole thing where he gets in with then upscale kind of clubs, a high rise club thing where he's kind of infiltrating it to get to rub elbows with the rich and powerful among his community. He infiltrates that. But then once the action like kicks off from there, in terms of him exacting his plot for vengeance and everything, that is where like that kinetic and chaotic energy of the underground fight club sequences is repurposed for just like a vicious brawl and vicious like execution of vengeance. Like it involves like a gun and fight sequence. Like there's a big like set piece in a bathroom. And what I love about that is that it isn't afraid to show things going horribly wrong. And like, I was very satisfied with the way that the movie transitioned from that, like coming up into infiltrating the kind of upper crust of society in order to get in the same room as the person who did something horrible to your family so that you could take them out. Like, that is very satisfying. That whole trajectory is very satisfying. But then when you have the execution of the vengeance plot, it's really interesting because it kind of reminded me a little bit of the movie Blue Ruin, which I haven't seen in like over 10 years, I think. But in that movie is kind of a similar sort of vibe, where it's a man who's trying to do a vengeance plot, trying to seek revenge against someone that did something horrible to his family. But he is so he's not trained to do this kind of thing. It's like a bumbling sort of thing, but not in a comedic way. It's more of a like stumbling through a plan that's thought out well enough, but not executed by someone who is, I wouldn't say capable of exacting the plot, but is not properly trained to do so. And that's the similar kind of thing with Monkey Man, is that Kid, played by Dev Patel, played by him, he is someone who has devoted all of his energy toward getting into a position to avenge his family, into seek revenge. When the time comes, it's not that he is ill-equipped to do it, but he has that consciousness, that conscience seep into him, where it's a good plan, but he is a human being who is maybe not fully equipped emotionally to do it. So that is all like the first half of the movie. From there, we get, like, I haven't even touched on the socio-political implications of the movie, which I'm a little bit hesitant to talk about because I don't know. Like, it's set in like in India, and there is this whole subplot involving, I think they're called the Sovereign Party, which I legitimately don't know if it's like, it's a political party that's seeking power in India, and I literally don't know if that's like a real life one or an analog for a real life one. But it is unfortunately very much a something that is that can definitely be kind of you can kind of put different things into perspective with it. It's basically it's an oppressive regime that is gaining power in the movie, and political power to the point where they are displacing and maiming and murdering marginalized individuals. And I'm going to dance around this a little bit because it is a non-spoiler section of the review, but I'll try to talk a little bit more clearly about it in spoilers. But the long and short of it is that once Kid gets into a position where he needs to kind of seek exile, in a sense, he's taken in by a group of people that, if they're not all trans people, there's a good portion of them are trans. I don't know. I don't remember if they're all like a transgender community, or it's just marginalized people with like the leader being a transgendered person. But either way, it is a group of marginalized people, which is so, it really hits home that the subject of like oppressed people overcoming their oppression in fighting back. Like, that is kind of a big theme of the movie. And in the clip from the trailer that I'm going to play when I go into spoilers, you'll hear Dev Patel's character talk about how he wants to fight for people that are marginalized and people who are being hurt by people. And that's a noble thing. That's something that I am all for in this movie, but I do feel like it's a little bit, not underused, but it takes a little bit to get going, or a little bit to get to that point of the theme, specifically because we have that buildup of Kid working his way up to try to exact his revenge. And then only then do we get introduced to like the marginalized people of the community who are in hiding because their lives are being threatened. And I kind of wish that there was a little bit more emphasis on that and on the Sovereign Party that is kind of the kind of central villain, or the central cloud of villain throughout the movie. I wish that was a little bit more prominent in the buildup toward like the second half of the movie, where Kid is taken in by them and is basically healed. It is healed by them and built up by them. Yeah, I'm still trying to dance around spoilers a little bit, but I will say that as much as I am very much pleased with that part of the plot and in the trajectory of the plot as well, I do have to admit that it feels a little bit derivative, but it is a kind of it is a plot that we see a lot in movies, just like the bare bones of the plot, like a person that's trying to do vengeance and then does not succeed at vengeance and then has to recalibrate and then go after to do vengeance. That is on like the skeletons of this movie are it is something that we've seen a lot in action movies. What sets it apart for sure is that kinetic and chaotic camera movements and the way that the action is visualized. Also the setting being set in India, like in terms of seeing the not only like the criminal underworld of the setting. I think the city is called like Yatana. I really wish I would have written that down, but like seeing the way that it depicts both like the elite of that city and the just like the underworld, the criminal element of it, the criminal underworld of it. It is so clean the way that it's done, because it kind of reminds me a little bit of a bit of a more subtle thing than what was done in Snowpiercer and Bong Joon-ho's Snowpiercer, because throughout his journey, Kid goes through so many different ordeals and so many different interactions that he is basically bearing witness to different parts of society in his community. So like he's dealing with the upper echelon, like rubbing elbows with the people that are basically, you know, the most successful and rich and terrible human beings, while also working in the kitchen and being offered drugs and being basically befriending people in the kitchen. And then from that, like through circumstances, he stumbles into like a bordello, I guess would be the word for it, like a sex building. The movie takes us through this journey that shows so many different facets of the community and the different, like the highs and lows of the community, the, like I said, the upper echelon, the rich, the powerful, and the subjugated, as well as the criminal element underneath all of it. And what I appreciate about that is it isn't as straightforward as it is in Snowpiercer, because Snowpiercer, it's literally they're going through different trains of the different cars in the train, and each car is a different like level of society. Like it's not as clear cut as that, but what I like is that flow of it in Monkey Man is it just goes through it paints a vivid picture throughout the entire runtime as Kid is going through these experiences and everything. And so I don't know how much more I have to say in non-spoilers for Monkey Man, but, I think the resolution, the kind of final act of the movie is pretty solid. There's some elements of it that didn't really work for me because I feel like the person, I don't know, I guess the big finale of it, I feel like could have been, I wouldn't say could have been, but I feel like I would have enjoyed it more if it was more prominent in terms of action and resolving the story. Because once we get to the kind of end game of it, it seems like it falls a little bit flat. But despite that, though, the kind of depiction and the reveal of like what happened in his past to spur him toward this vengeance is really solid and satisfying. So it's a little bit of a double-edged sword there. Yeah, and I think that that's it for the non-spoiler portion of this review. Overall, I really did like Monkey Man. Not quite as much as I would have hoped to. I ended up rating it 3 stars on Letterboxd. I wrote just real quick in the Letterboxd review. I wrote the raw action and bloody violence show some promise for Dev Patel as a director. There are some interesting set pieces where the camera moves in a really free-flowing, chaotic way. While the scene as a whole is kept coherent and energetic, but the story itself isn't as engaging or unique, and the middle portion of the story really needed more time to develop. And I stand by that, and especially with his kind of entrance into the community, the underground community that takes after him, I would have liked to have more time spent with them and more time spent developing that culture, that side of the story, because it is very important to the story, absolutely important, but it also kind of feels like it's pushed it by necessity of the plot and everything else going on. It's kind of pushed to the background a little bit too quickly, and so when it resolves itself, it doesn't have as much of an impact as it should have or could have. So that's my way of dancing around my feelings toward Monkey Man. That's my non-spoiler review. I'm going to go ahead and go into spoilers for Monkey Man. So if you haven't seen the movie and you don't want to be spoiled, go ahead and stop listening or watching or whatever. Go see the movie and then come back and listen to this. If you're listening to this in the episode once it posts and everything, thank you. And also check the show notes for timestamps to navigate away from spoilers for Monkey Man. And if you're watching the video that I'm going to post of this later, scrub through it, I guess, or I don't know, who knows. But anyway, I'm going to go into spoilers for Monkey Man. So I'm going to do that by playing a clip from the trailer. And when I come back, I'm going to be spoiling Monkey Man. City.
The rich don't see us as people. Give me the job no one wants to do. I'll do it.
Anyone who forgets their place doesn't turn out well for them.
This is not the place to work if you can't handle that sort of stuff.
Every day, I've prayed for a way to protect the weak.
I've got an answer to every prayer. I call her Nikki.
Minaj.
Big bumper.
Nice headlights. Let's boogie.
All right, so spoilers on for Monkey Man. I'm going to be spoiling the movie now, so please don't listen if you don't want to be spoiled. But one thing I want to talk about, first of all, in the spoiler section that I didn't really touch on in the non-spoiler section was, and I don't know his character's name. I feel terrible for that. But the character who is kind of his friend, who kind of befriends Kid early in the movie, the one that has the little cart that he calls Nicki Minaj. I feel like that character had a lot more potential to be a lot more fun. Like I think it's presented, he's presented as a character who is supposed to be the comic relief, but it's really only in like one section that he does anything kind of humorous. And I don't need it to be a cookie cutter kind of comic relief story or comic relief character or anything. I just want more consistency. And I feel like that character, I think it was Alfonso, that character isn't developed enough. And because he's not developed enough, I feel like what little comic relief we have just kind of sticks out a little bit. It sticks out a little bit and makes it a little bit disjointed for me, but that's a minor quibble with it. In terms of spoilers, the action in this movie is pretty fantastic. Like pretty fantastic. I had seen some people talk about how it's Dev Patel trying to make like a John Wick movie. And it's not like John Wick is on another level in terms of action, like in fighting and everything. Like they're not really comparable because John Wick is huge. It's a big, big thing. And having said that, they do name check John Wick a little bit. Like they reference John Wick when he's buying the gun. But it's its own thing. The vengeance plot in this movie, like, let me talk about that. Let me refocus a little bit and talk about the vengeance plot, because I do appreciate the storytelling in this movie in the regard that it's that it conceals the grand nature of the vengeance, I guess, or I don't know if that's really the right way to say it, but it conceals the thing that causes him to go on this vengeance kick. And I really like that specifically because it's told very smartly in the sense that we don't know the extent to which he has been hurt and his family has been hurt. We can infer from context in the movie that his mother was killed in some capacity. We see these flashes here and there of blood, the river, and his hands burned. And we see flashes of his mother as well. And when he says to the guy, he says something like blessings from my mother as he's about to pull the trigger. We can infer from that, like, okay, yes, this man is responsible for killing his mother. What I like about that is that that's all we get until like the midway point or when he's kind of convalescing with the underground community. Until then, we don't know the extent of what he's planning for his vengeance or exactly what he's planning to do with that. And I think that makes the botched vengeance that he does all the more thrilling, because we don't know the full extent of why he's doing this or what's causing him to do this. And because of that, it's so much more thrilling and interesting and engaging than if we had been given like a more linear plot that just shows like, oh, hey, you know, he killed his mom and now he's seeking vengeance. It's a lot more than that. And I do give the movie a lot of credit for holding that back and keeping our attention as the audience to kind of bring us into the fold once he's been beaten all to hell and is like near death. I really, really like that. Having said that, that convalescing sequence where he's being healed and he's working back up to be, you know, his full power, full extent and training back up and everything. I like that in theory. On paper, I like that as being an extension of him being someone who is needs to be built up before he can do it. Like, it's basically his entire method of exacting his revenge and his entire plan is something that he's done in solitude, and it's something that he's done on his own. And it's not until he makes contact with those people and is healed by them and trained by them that he's able to be like the monkey man. He's able to be the person who brings justice to everyone and helps bring justice to everything. Like, that's what I was kind of getting at when saying that this is sort of a pretty standard sort of storyline, even if it is for like dumbass American audiences like myself, in a setting and in a culture that I'm not familiar with. It's still a pretty straightforward narrative, and a pretty straightforward narrative structure. And I do think that it's commendable to Dev Patel that he's able to take something that is pretty conventional and create something that is as uniquely filmed and uniquely photographed and uniquely told as well as it can be in this iteration of the movie, in this version of the movie. So I do commend him for that. But I do also think that when we are brought into that underground community, that the displaced community of trans people who are under, like, they're being systemically eradicated basically from the Sovereign Party or by the Sovereign Party, I just wish that so, like, there's so much in that middle section that is devoted to Kid kind of growing back, like getting back to 100% and having that kind of underdog story where he's just like, he's been beaten near to death and now he needs to build up. It's that training montage thing in every Rocky movie, but it's in this movie. So because of that, because it's focused so much on him and him being built up, I feel like the stuff that with the Sovereign Party and with the trans community and with the marginalized people, the horrors that are facing the people in India in this movie, in this community, I feel like that takes a little bit too much of a backseat, or a little bit too much and not enough emphasis. And I wanted more of that. I wanted to know more about the characters of the people who rescued him, because like we get a decent amount of stuff with them. We do. They're not two-dimensional characters by any stretch. However, when they come to his rescue at the end of the movie, when they are, you know, helping him, like when they come to his rescue and then allow him to go after the main bad guy, I wanted to feel more connected to them, because they looked really cool. It was very cool to see them like dressed up and ready for battle and everything. But it also just felt like, okay, I know the main person, but there's not much character to anyone else in that group. It's just like, they're all like one big collective. And I get the main point of that. Like, I understand that as a collective, they are a marginalized group that have been very much taken down by this government entity, by the people in power. And that's what's causing them to come to his aid and to fight alongside him. And that's great. That's awesome. I just wish that there was a little bit more detail about like those individual characters, those individual people in that group. And I think that because the movie puts so much emphasis on kids build back up to being 100% and being in a position to really fight and get the upper hand on the people that are responsible for the horrors of the people that he cares about are facing. Because there's so much emphasis to that, I feel like the absence of limited experience of building up the other characters is a little bit noticeable. And the other thing is that late in the movie, that him in the underground fight, after he is the Monkey Man, he's able to kick ass and he's able to just completely demolish people. That's all well and good. Like, that's okay. But I also feel like it was a little bit, I don't want to say it was unnecessary, because it is pretty necessary for the arc of the character. And again, it goes back to it being kind of the skeleton of this movie being a pretty straightforward kind of underdog, upper hand person fighting back against systemic issues with violence and everything. Like, it is a pretty standard or commonly made movie. That's a little bit too harsh, but it is a movie that in its skeleton has been done before in several ways. So I understand structurally why we need that demonstration of kid getting back in the ring and being able to just completely demolish his opponents in the underground fight club thing. But it also felt very, like, in light of the characters, the underground characters, not being that well drawn in terms of having any type of dimension or anything. In light of that, I felt like that scene of him, of the new and improved kid fighting in the ring, was kind of unnecessary. And it just didn't really work for me as the stepping stone toward him finally going after the people that are in charge and the people that are subjugating and murdering people. So that was something that just structurally didn't work for me. The reveal, or the finally revealing what he went through and what his mother went through, and what spurred his whole experience of going after the guy for vengeance and revenge, that was really good. That was really haunting and sad. It was very, very sad and depressing, really. So that's really all I have to say about that. Yeah, and then I guess kind of the final thing about this, because I don't really have much else to say in spoilers. Let me before I get to the final thought on that, because I kind of want to talk about the big bad at the end of the movie. But before I get to that botched vengeance plot, that is 100% the standout of the movie for me. Like him trying to kill the guy in the bathroom and then getting his ass kicked, and it leading to that just like run through the city of like an escape plan, an improvised escape plan, was so cool. Like that was 100% the standout of the movie, was him trying to escape from that. And it even has like a little bit of that comic relief where he is like, he sees the window and he's about to jump through it. And then he just tries to jump through it, but it's a window. It's not an action movie. Like it just doesn't break. So he has to improvise from there. Like little bits and pieces like that. I kind of wish that there was a little bit more of that in the movie, but I do like the way that, like, I don't know, that whole sequence really, really worked for me, even with the bigger issues I had with the movie. So like I said, that kind of lack of consistent comic relief through the movie, and also the character that joins him, his friend, God, I just had his name, I think it was Alfonso, his character, like that, I'm pretty sure that was him, but like when he joins him, like when he tells him to get in the car, when he commandeers Nicki Minaj the car, and they're running through they're driving through the city in a high speed chase and everything, all I kept thinking was, like, why is he joining him? Like, why is he part of this? Like, what is it about him that makes him part of it, other than just needing it for the action of the moment? Maybe I missed something as to why he would be kind of tagging along, aside from it being his car. But I don't know. It just didn't really mesh well with me there. Again, the camera work in terms of that sequence was really cool. I really like how it went into that POV shot after he crashes, and you get like just the weight and severity of him losing slowly losing consciousness, and you get like that tension through there. It felt like a little bit like a video game cutscene, but in a good way. And then, I also wanted to talk about the axe sequence, where he has the fight in the brothel. That's the word I was looking for. The brothel, I think, with the guy with the axe. And I had just assumed that the axe was going to be used to break his handcuffs. And I think that was intentional to be about like what it was going to be. But I like that they subverted that, and I like that they didn't go that route. I thought that was pretty clever. You also get that moment where he sees the little girl under the bed and he tells her to run, as he's like bloody and disgusting because of the fight. I liked that too, as another indication of the kind of the darkness and depravity of the underworld that he's kind of drifted into in his vengeance plan. So I like that. So to kind of wrap up the spoiler review of Monkey Man, I do think that the kind of the big bad, the final kind of encounter with the head of the Sovereign Party, I don't remember his name. I think it was Baba Shakti. That was a little bit underwhelming, I guess. Like for me, it felt like so that section of the plot, the whole Sovereign Party, the party in power that is going after trans people and people that are different, like the subjugating and murdering and all of these horrible things, that is something that is, I feel like it was a little bit inadequately built up, because it is present throughout the beginning of the movie, through like little vignettes that we get just on TV, like little bits and pieces. And there's a little bit of dialogue here and there talking about him specifically. That's laying the groundwork for for depicting it to be this bigger issue that Dev Patel's character is going to suddenly find himself involved in. And on the surface, that's a good way to do that. That's a good way to build that up. But I think that because they held back Dev Patel's character's backstory and his mother's backstory, because they held that back, those little bits and pieces of the main guy on TV just didn't really land all that well, or didn't really build up all that well toward the big finale of him being like the big bad of it, or what have you. So I don't know, but I did like that final confrontation. Just visually, it was interesting because he's in like a long hallway at like the top of a skyscraper, and it's just a very big kind of showcase of his power. He's like alone, he's like washing his feet, and he's like, he's in control of that. Even with the sound of the helicopter and him saying like, oh, my chariot awaits or whatever, it's just like he's in such a position of power there that even then he knows that he's, you know, he's in charge and what have you. Like that's kind of standard fare a little bit, but it's also pretty well done, pretty well drawn as well. So I did like that final kind of encounter with him, even though it is kind of, I don't know, the overall ending kind of just was okay. It was very, it was mildly satisfactory, I guess would be the way that I would describe it. I don't know. Overall, it was a decent movie. I do think that as a directorial debut, I think that it's very solid, and it makes me very eager to see what Dev Patel does next as a director, which is something I always say. I feel like that might be a little bit of a cop-out of a wrap-up thing whenever I talk about it. Like, oh, this person whose work I respect has gone into another medium. So I'll like, yeah, the movie is fine, but I'm excited to see what he does next. Like, that's something I kind of feel like I say a lot, but I do genuinely think it'll be interesting to see what Dev Patel does next. I don't know if he'll stay in action or if he'll do something else, because I think that he has such an eclectic filmography in terms of his performing as an actor, that I think that he can do a lot. Like I feel like there's potential for him to do a lot in a lot of different genres as a director. I don't know if he'll be just sitting at like action stuff or anything. But we'll see. So anyway, that is my spoiler review. That is my full review of Monkey Man. It is in theaters now. It was in theaters April 5th, and it is in theaters now. And now we're going to go into my secondary review. But before I do that, I do just want to take a quick moment and just want to give you guys a quick reminder that if you like the show, please take a moment to subscribe, rate, and review it on whatever app you use, and share our episodes on social media whenever they post and everything. Just share it around, give it a repost, give it a like Facebook post or whatever. And yeah, just help get the word out on the show. And in addition to that, I don't have it in my notes here, but in addition to that, I do have, a thing where if you are interested in starting your own podcast and you want to find the best way to do that, go to Libsyn.com and, sign up on Libsyn to host the podcast there. That's where I've hosted all three of my podcasts for a decade now. It's a great, I would not shill for them or be an affiliate for them if I didn't wholeheartedly love their product, because I've been using it for nearly a quarter of my life at this point. Maybe over a quarter of my life? I don't know math. Anyway, Libsyn.com, go there, and if you are starting a podcast, sign up there, use the promo code Obsess or the link in the show notes of this episode, which are available at obsessiveviewer.com/OV423. So that's all I've got for that. Now on to the secondary review. I'm going to do a non-spoiler review for Girls State. And to bring us into that, I'm going to play a little stinger here and then a clip from the trailer for Girls State.
They tell me I view obsessively.
In 2040, I intend to run for president.
So I think at Girls State, I'm going to run for governor,
attorney general,
Supreme Court justice.
Okay.
We're never going to get the opportunity to talk to people from different parts of Missouri the way that we are right now.
I am a very social person. I will talk to a wall.
Often when women start...
All right, so Girls State, it is available to stream on Apple TV+. It was at Sundance and bought by Apple TV+. And it was released on Apple TV+ on April 5th. Directors for this documentary were Amanda McBain and Jesse Moss. The plot summary is... It follows 500 adolescent girls from all across Missouri as they come together for a week-long immersion in a sophisticated democratic laboratory where they organize a Supreme Court to consider the most contentious issues of the day. So I was extremely excited for this movie. Extremely excited because in 2020, these same directors, these same filmmakers came out with Boy State, which was a documentary about the same thing, like the same, I think it's like the American Legion puts it on, but they basically do this concentrated week-long kind of like a United, like mock UN or whatever it's called, like fake government thing, a mock government thing, but they basically do that for a week. And in 2020, they had a documentary called Boy State, which was the boy side of it. And even then, I remember thinking like, oh, that'd be really great because they if they did like an additional documentary about the girl side of it, because there is a Girl State program as well. And as luck would have it, they had the same idea and they did it. And I did mean to rewatch Boy State, which is also available on Apple TV+. But I didn't get a chance to rewatch it, but I do remember just adoring that documentary. And it came out at a time where, obviously, it was 2020, very different time and very contentious time with in terms of politics and the kind of level of politics that were kind of all across the world or all across the country. So it was a very contentious time. But what I found so interesting about that documentary was that as jaded and cynical as I have become about like modern politics and US politics and people, like, I don't know, people that have viewpoints that are opposing to mine, like it has become so much more contentious over the years, even since 2020, that it's something that I try not to participate in or be conscious of, because I know my ideals, my values, all of these things. And I try not to judge people for their beliefs or their ideals and everything, unless they, you know, go to the fucking Capitol on January 6th, whatever. But they're anyway. So that all that's to say that in 2020, Boy State stood out as a really interesting view of like high school kids, like 17-year-old kids putting together like a mock government in a week time and taking it so seriously and exploring their viewpoints, their positions, the way that they can just dive into politics. And what was surprising to me about Boy State was that it made me feel hopeful for the future. Like, there are kids who take it so incredibly seriously. And yes, that documentary became kind of contentious with some of the subjects and some of the subjects of the documentary. But at its heart, I thought, like, man, this is a depiction of thousands of kids who are passionate about government. And like, just like there's a little bit of a glimmer of hope in that that makes me excited for future generations. And maybe not, I don't know if I'm ready to be excited about the future of the country, but it is something that gives a glimmer of hope. Having said that, that preamble brings me to Girls State, which came out obviously this year, 2024. And I kind of have the same thought. Like, I have the same idea that, in fact, like on Letterboxd, I don't have it in front of me, but on Letterboxd, I said something to the effect of, if these filmmakers want to make a documentary about kids kids' experience with mock governments and their political ideals and how they socialize among other politically minded people. If they want to do this every 4 years, have at them. Like, I would love to see them make this same type of documentary once every 4 years when there's an election, when years of presidential elections. I just think that would be great. But the reason I say that is because this gave me so much hope again, hope and positivity toward the future of the country, because these girls in this documentary are very passionate about it. And what I found so compelling and interesting about that is that they are very focused on their experience and their role within the country and within government, their potential futures with the government. And like one of the girls says, like, yeah, and you know, my intention is I'm in 2040, I'm going to run for president. And I had the same thought with Boy State in 2020, but I thought, like, man, it would be so interesting if, like, in a couple of decades, we get someone in one of these documentaries runs for president or has like a big political career. I just think that would be really interesting to see. But anyway, this is not, I would say that this documentary is about, even with Boy State, and there are some aspects of it that really elevate it above Boy State, in particular, and I don't think I can really spoil a documentary, but this isn't really a spoiler, but what I found so interesting about this was that the week that this takes place, that they did their filming, they did the Girl State thing, like it's a big thing, two things occurred around this time. This was June 2022. One is that this was the Missouri Girl State thing that's done yearly. It was the first year that the Girl State and Boy State of, like, Missouri Boy State and Girl State took place at the same time on the same campus. So there are some moments here and there where the girls like run into the boys and there's a lot of conversation about like the differences between Boy State and Girl State, which I found pretty interesting because it paints a very clear picture of the Boy State being a lot bigger than Girl State and like having a lot more advantages and privilege and everything than the girls' version of it was. So that highlight was really interesting, especially when it comes to a head with one of the girls kind of taking up the mantle of like not exposing it, but like basically trying to do something about that, like discrepancy or the difference between Girl State and Boy State. That's one thing that I found interesting. The other thing that I found fascinating, and I think puts it into such a unique and interesting perspective, is that, like I said, this was filmed during like early June 2022. This happened in the time between the Supreme Court leaking the notes about wanting to overturn Roe v. Wade and just before the Supreme Court overturned Roe v. Wade. So throughout the documentary, you have like these, all of the 500 girls in this thing that have the potential overturning of Roe v. Wade at the forefront of their minds. And it comes up and they talk about it. There's a lot of obviously differing opinions, because like they also, like they say, like, you know, I'm more conservative leaning or I'm more liberal leaning. And there's a lot of like debate and conversation surrounding it, surrounding that topic and everything, which I also, as an aside, I think it was kind of funny. it was kind of funny to me that, from what I remember of Boy State, I remember the boys being a little bit more clear and confident about their political leanings, whether it was conservative or liberal. And I found it interesting and a little fascinating that in 2022, because that was in 2019, But in 2022, when they were filming this, like there was a lot of like one of the girls is like, well, I don't really want to, she's very much trying to figure out how she can basically tell people that she's conservative without them not listening to her or them shutting down. And I thought there was a really funny line where she said something like, I feel like a lot of these girls are probably like a little like leaning on liberal side of things. And like she says, like, I just feel like I can kind of tell because the liberal girls are louder. And I thought that was kind of funny as a liberal dude myself. I thought that was pretty funny. But anyway, so the positioning of the documentary, just by happenstance, taking place shortly after the leak that Roe v. Wade was potentially going to be overturned, and the lead up to actually being overturned, that puts it in this pocket of time that I found pretty fascinating to watch unfold, especially with it being the subject of the documentary being 500 girls who are passionate about politics and government, and they're kind of dealing with that, the potential of that big legislation happening, and the kind of the good and bad of that, depending on their personal beliefs and everything. They're kind of debating that and they're figuring that out in real time. And I thought that was a really interesting way, or an interesting thing that's captured in this documentary. I will say that I feel like it's an interesting experiment, because I came away from this documentary ultimately thinking that, like, well, you know, I remember Boy State being a lot more contentious. Like, I remember, like, the big, like, governor campaign came down to, like, these two boys in Boy State, and it was a big, big contentious campaign, and there was a lot going on. Girl State follows the same trajectory, follows the same structure, because it's the same program, but it's not that contentious. Like, I feel like that maybe is a statement on the world that, like, you know, Boy State is more like, oh, cutthroat and everything, and Girl State's just like, we're just trying to have our voice in government. Like, we're trying to not be pigeonholed, or we're trying not to be silenced, or, you know, have our like rights stripped away by men. Like, we're just trying to work together to have a voice in government. And I think that that's awesome. I thought that that was a kind of an interesting kind of, not inverse, but an interesting change or difference between Boy State and Girl State. So I did appreciate that, and I did like that. But at the risk of just sounding like an idiot, you know, movie goer person, I wanted it to be a little more exciting, though. So, like, it's kind of a mixed bag there. I do think that the kind of later in the documentary, like after there's kind of like an addendum to it, not an addendum, but like kind of a postscript to it, where like one of the, like I alluded to earlier, one of the girls is working on kind of exposing the differences between Boy State and Girl State, that she's writing this article, and that takes up a lot of time late in the documentary. And I really liked that. I thought that that was like, I wish that there was a little bit more of that, because she's a very interesting girl in the documentary. She's a very interesting subject, because she has a passion for journalism, but also a drive to want to be president and like want to succeed at Girl State. And the track that she follows throughout the documentary is really interesting and captivating, because it doesn't go certain ways that she expected or we, the viewer, expected. But I really liked seeing that particular girl, like, kind of just like take the reins on something and run with it. I don't know. It was really compelling. I just wish that there was a little bit more of that aspect of it, the differences between Boy State and Girl State. But also, that is also a kind of a double-edged sword, because I think that there was a risk of the documentary taking a little bit too much time, devoting too much time to like showing Boy State and like how it compares to Girl State, which I understand the documentary needed to do that because of that kind of final run at the end of it with that one girl like going after kind of the differences between them. But also throughout the movie, like or throughout the documentary, like it cuts to like a couple of scenes at Boy State and them running into him. Like, I already watched Boy State. Like obviously it's not the same one because it's years later and it's a different state. But I'm like, I've already seen the documentary about Boy State. I don't care to see these teenage boys doing their government thing. I want to see how the girls do over here. Like, that's just, that's, it felt a little bit like, I don't know. It just felt a little bit annoying there for me. But it was in service to like they found the plot. They found the plot there, and they found a reason to depict some of the stuff from Boy State, because there is some very clear differences between them, and it's a really interesting kind of depiction of kind of a bigger problem within government, kind of the microcosm of a bigger problem within government. So. Yeah, so that is about all I've got for Girl State. Like I said, it is streaming on Apple TV Plus. I ended up rating it 4 stars on Letterboxd. I really enjoyed it. I really enjoyed Boy State. And once again, I really think that, like, I think that anyone who has a vague interest in politics or even want to know more, I guess, about politics, I guess, I don't know, anyone who's jaded, anyone who's cynical about the state of politics in the U.S. should watch these two documentaries to get a little bit of a boost of hope hope toward the future. And I think that also kind of stems from the fact that these are kids who are teenagers who have a passion for government. None of them are like influencers or celebrities, or they're not real estate tycoons who get bankrupt all the time, or they're not reality show hosts, they're not old ass people. Like, they are kids who have a passion for government, and that is what kind of makes me happy to see, because they're not con artists. They're not people who are trying to game the system. They have an active interest in government, and that's what I want to see. And I think that's what it comes down to, is that I don't want stupid performative candidates or anything, or I don't know. It's all, who cares? It's just the yeah. Anyway, that's also funny. Like, I, as an aside, and I'll wrap up here in a second, but as an aside, some friends of mine and I were talking about The Rock, and like, I guess WrestleMania was going on, like a week or so ago. And some of the guys that I talked to, they were saying that, like, they were positing that, like, oh yeah, The Rock went back to WrestleMania because his acting career is faltering, and he is like, the idea is that he's maybe soft launching a presidential run in 2028, and like, I was particularly proud of this, and I also kind of think this a little bit, but like, my thought was the idea of The Rock, Dwayne Johnson, soft launching a run for president makes me a little bit more eager to see Alex Garland's Civil War this week, because I'll be able to escape into a reality where the U.S. is done, because I don't want that to be a thing. Like, I don't want celebrities in politics. Hard stop. Anyway, that is my review of Girl State. Once again, it is on Apple TV Plus. I highly recommend watching Boy State and Girl State because they are very interesting, engaging documentaries. I'm not going to do a potpourri section for this week, but I will say thank you to everyone who joined in on the live stream. And I've seen like the count go up and down and everything, so I don't know. But anyway, I had it set up to where only subscribers can comment on it. So Paige commented once and no one else commented. So I don't know if just people just didn't want to subscribe. But anyway, that doesn't matter. Check out Obsessive Viewer Podcasts on YouTube. I have a bunch of stuff on there and I'm trying to kind of grow that channel a little bit to also funnel into more podcast listeners. So that will do it for this week's episode of the Obsessive Viewer Podcast. As always, thank you so much for listening and make sure to follow the show on social media and subscribe to the podcast on your preferred podcast app. Also, check out Obsessive Viewer Podcast's other shows, including Tower Junkies, a Stephen King podcast hosted by Tiny and myself, and Anthology, the Twilight Zone and Classic Sci-Fi podcast hosted by me. Anthology has an episode coming out this week with my friend Victor Gamboa of the Outer Limits podcast. Had a lot of fun chatting with Victor about both the Twilight Zone and the Outer Limits. So check that out on Anthology on Friday. Next week on The Obsessive Viewer, we are going to have a big show. Episode 424, I'm going to be reviewing Civil War with a new guest. I won't reveal who it is, but a new guest to the podcast. I'm very excited to chat with him about that. And the secondary review will be for Late Night with the Devil, which I've already recorded with Mike. So it's going to be a good show. Thank you guys so much for listening, and I'll see you next week. And now, enjoy this short clip from a recent Patreon-exclusive episode. For the full episode and more Patreon-exclusive content, sign up at patreon.com/obsessiveviewer. David Cronenberg is a filmmaker that I am very, not unfamiliar with, but I kind of tend to avoid his work because he has a reputation in my mind as being someone who is a little bit outside of my comfort zone in terms of body horror and in visual effects. And obviously Scanners has a very famous scene where a person's head explodes, like legitimately explodes, in the movie. And I will say that it is a pretty awesome sequence. But it is incredibly brief too. It is brief and it is kind of not, it's kind of not consequential to, it's not of a certain consequence to the movie, basically. It's kind of an inciting incident rather. So I don't know, but anyway, I really am not sure if I liked Scanners. Thank you for listening to the Obsessive Viewer Podcast. This episode was produced and edited by me, Matt Hurt. If you have feedback, thoughts on our episodes, or just want to connect, you can email me at matt@obsessiveviewer.com. For more information on this show, including a full archive of our episodes and show notes, visit obsessiveviewer.com. And if you enjoyed the show, please give us a follow on social media and subscribe to us on your podcast app of choice so you never miss an episode. Also, consider rating and reviewing the show on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and Audible to help increase our visibility and grow our community. If you want to support the show and get early access to new episodes, as well as a steady stream of exclusive episodes, you can join our Patreon at patreon.com/obsessiveviewer. For information on more podcasts presented by obsessiveviewer.com, visit obsessiveviewer.com/podcasts. Our theme song is A Little Mad Sometimes by As Good As It Gets. For more of their music, check them out on Spotify and at asgoodasitgetsmusic.com. Thank you so much for listening, and we'll see you in the next episode.
See this episode's show notes for our unique promo code to get up to 2 months of free podcasting service with Libsyn when you sign up for a new account. Get your show on Apple and Spotify. Get helpful stats and all the support you need to sound your very best.